Yes, he will do it, Popov said. They were in a corner booth, and the background music made it a secure place to talk. He has not confirmed it, but he will. Who is he? Henriksen asked. Sean Grady. Do you know the name?
PIRA.
Worked in Londonderry mainly, didn't he?
For the most part, yes.
He captured 3 SAS people and disposed of them. 2 separate incidents. The SAS then targeted him on 3 separate missions. Once they came very close to getting him, and they eliminated 10 or so of his closest associates. He then cleaned out some suspected informers in his unit.
He's quite ruthless, Popov assured his associates.
That's true, Henriksen assured Breitling. I remember reading what he did to the SS guys he caught.
Wasn't very pretty.
Grady's a nasty little fucker. Does he have enough people to make this attempt?
I think yes, Dmitri Arkadyevich replied.
And he held us up for money. I offered 5, and he demanded 6, plus drugs.
Drugs? Henriksen was surprised.
"Wait, I thought the IRA didn't approve of drug trafficking," Breitling objected.
"We live in a practical world. The IRA worked for years to eliminate drug dealers throughout Ireland, mainly kneecappings to make the action very public. That was a psychological and political move on his part. Perhaps now he entertains the idea as a continuing source of income for his operations," Dmitri explained.
The morality of the issue didn't seem very important to anyone at the table.
"Yeah, well, I suppose we can entertain that request," Breitling said, with a small measure of distaste.
"Kneecappings? What does that mean?"
"You take a pistol," Bill explained, "and place it behind the knee, then you fire forward. It blows the kneecap to smithereens. Painful and permanently crippling. It's how they used to deal with informers and other people they didn't like. The Protestant terrorists preferred a Black and Decker drill for the same purpose. It puts the word out on the street that you are not to be messed with," Henriksen concluded.
"Ouch," the physician in Breitling commented.
"That's why they're called terrorists," Henriksen pointed out. "These days they just kill them.
Grady has a reputation for ruthlessness, doesn't he?"
"Yes, he does," Popov confirmed. "There's no doubt that he will undertake this mission. He likes the concept and your suggestion for how it should be set up, Bill. There is also his ego, which is large." Popov took a sip of his wine. "He wants to take the lead in the IRA politically, and that will mean doing something dramatic.
That's the Irish for you, the land of sad loves and happy wars."
"Will he succeed?" Breitling asked.
"The concept is a clever one. But remember that to him success means elimination of the primary targets, the 2 women, and then a few of the reaction team of soldiers. After that he will doubtless flee the area and try to return to Ireland and safety. Just surviving an operation of this type is successful enough for his political purposes. To fight a full military action would be madness for him, and Grady is not a madman," Dmitri told them, not really sure he believed it.
"Weren't all revolutionaries mad?"
It was difficult to understand people who let visions take control of their lives. Those who'd succeeded, Lenin, Mao, and Gandhi in this century, were the ones who'd used their visions effectively, of course. But even then, which of the 3 had really succeeded? The Soviet Union had fallen. The People's Republic of China would eventually succumb to the same political-economic realities that had doomed the USSR, and India was still an economic disaster that somehow managed to hover in stagnation. By that model, Ireland was more surely doomed by the possible success of the IRA than it was by its economic marriage to Britain. At least Cuba had the tropical sun to keep it warm. To survive,
With no natural resources to speak of, Ireland needed a close economic tie to someone, and the closest was the UK. But that was off the dinner topic. "So you expect him to try a hit-and-run?" Bill asked. Dimitri nodded. "Nothing else makes tactical sense. He hopes to live long enough to utilize the money we've offered him, assuming you will approve the increase he requires." "What's another million or so?" Henriksen asked, with a suppressed grin. So both of them regarded such a large sum as trivial, Popoff saw. And again he was struck in the face with the fact that they were planning something monstrous. But what? "How do they want it? Cash?" Breitling asked. "No, I told them it would be deposited in a numbered Swiss account. I can arrange that." "I have enough already laundered," Bill told his employer. "We could set that up tomorrow if you want." "And that means I fly to Switzerland again," Dimitri observed sourly. "Getting tired of flying?" "I have traveled a great deal, Dr. Breitling." Popoff sighed openly. He was jet-lagged, and it showed for once. "John." "John?" Popoff nodded, seeing some actual affection in his boss for the first time, somewhat to his surprise. "I understand, Dimitri," Henriksen said. "The Australia trip was a pain in the ass for me." "What was it like to grow up in Russia?" Breitling asked. "Odder than America. There was more violence in the schools." "No serious crime," Popoff explained. "But lots of fights between the boys, for example. Dominance fights, as boys will. The authorities usually looked the other way." "Where did you grow up?" "Moscow. My father was also an officer in state security. I was educated in Moscow State University."
"What major?"
"Language and economics."
The former had proven very useful. The latter had been totally valueless, since the Marxist idea of economics had not exactly proven to be an effective one.
"Ever get out of the city? You know, like Boy Scouts do here, that sort of stuff?"
Popoff smiled, wondering where this was going, and why they were asking it. But he played along.
"One of my happiest memories of childhood. I was in the Young Pioneers. We traveled out to a state farm and worked there for a month, helping with the harvest, living with nature, as you Americans say. And then, at age 14, he'd met his first love, Yelena Ivanovna. He wondered where she was now. He succumbed to a brief attack of nostalgia, as he remembered her feel in the darkness, his first conquest." Breitling noted the distant smile and took it for what he wanted it to be.
"You liked that, eh?"
Clearly they didn't want to hear that story.
"Oh, yes.
I have often wondered what it was like to live out there in a place like that, the sun on your back all the time, working in the soil. My father and I used to walk into the woods, hunting for mushrooms. That was a common pastime for Soviet citizens in the 60s, walking in the woods. Unlike most Russians, they'd driven there in his father's official car. But as a boy, he'd liked the woods as a place of adventure and romanticism, as all boys do, and enjoyed the time with his father as well."
"Any game in the woods there?" Bill Henriksen asked.
"One would see birds, of course, many kinds, and occasionally elk. You call them moose here, I think. But rarely. State hunters were always killing them. Wolves are their main target. They hunt them from helicopters. We Russians do not like wolves, as you do here in America. Too many folk tales of rabid ones killing people, you see. Mostly lies, I expect."
Breitling nodded.
"Same thing here. Wolves are just big wild dogs. You can train them as pets if you want. Some people do that." Wolves are cool, Bill added. He'd often thought about making one a pet, but you needed a lot of land for that. Maybe when the project was fulfilled.
What the hell was this all about? Dmitri wondered, still playing along.
I always wanted to see a bear, but there are none of them left in the Moscow area. I saw them only at the zoo. I loved bears, he added, lying. They'd always frightened the hell out of him.
You heard scores of bear stories as a child in Russia, few of them friendly, though not as anti-nature as the wolf stories.
Large dogs. Wolves killed people in the steppes. The farmers and peasants hated the damned things and welcomed the state hunters with their helicopters and machine guns, the better to hunt them down and slaughter them.
Well, John and I are nature lovers, Bill explained, waving to the waiter for another bottle of wine. Always have been. All the way back to Boy Scouts. Like your young pioneers, I suppose.
The state was not kind to nature in the Soviet Union. Much worse than the problems you've had here in America. Americans have come to Russia to survey the damage and suggest ways to fix the problems of pollution and such.
Especially in the Caspian Sea, where pollution had killed off most of the sturgeon, and with it the fish eggs known as caviar, which had for so long been a prime means of earning foreign currency for the USSR.
Yes, that was criminal, Breitling agreed soberly.
But it's a global problem. People don't respect nature the way they should, Breitling went on for several minutes, delivering what had to be a brief canned lecture, to which Dmitri listened politely.
That is a great political movement in America, is it not?
Not as powerful as many would like, Bill observed, but it's important to some of us.
Such a movement would be useful in Russia. It is a pity that so much has been destroyed for no purpose, Popov responded, meaning some of it.
The state should conserve resources for proper exploitation, not simply destroy them because the local political hacks didn't know how to use them properly. But then the USSR had been so horridly inefficient in everything it did.
Well, except espionage, Popov corrected himself.
America had done well, he thought. The cities were far cleaner than their Russian counterparts, even here in New York. And you only needed to drive an hour from any city to see green grass and tidy, productive farms. But the greater question was, why had a conversation that had begun with the discussion of a terrorist incident drifted into this? Had he done anything to invite it?
No. His employer had abruptly steered it in this direction. It had not been an accident.
That meant they were sounding him out.
But on what? This nature drivel?
He sipped at his wine and stared at his dinner companions.
You know, I never really had a chance to see America. I would like very much to see the national parks.
What is the one with the geysers?
Goldstone? Something like that?
Yellowstone. It's in Wyoming. Maybe the prettiest place in America, Henriksen told the Russian.
Nope, Yosemite, Breitling countered. In California. That's the prettiest valley in the whole world.
Overrun with goddamned tourists now, of course, but that'll change.
Same story at Yellowstone, John. And yeah, that'll change, too.
Someday, Bill Henriksen concluded.
They seemed pretty positive about the things that would change. But the American state parks were run by the federal government for all citizens, weren't they?
They had to be because they were tax-supported.
No limited access for the elite here.
Equality for all. Something he'd been taught in Soviet schools. Except here they actually lived it.
One more reason, Dmitri thought, why one country had fallen and the other had grown stronger.
What do you mean, that'll change? Popov asked.
Oh, the idea is to lessen the impact of people on the areas,
"It's a good idea, but some other things have to happen first," Breitling replied.
"Yeah, John. Just one or two," Henriksen agreed with a chuckle. Then he decided that this feeling-out process had gone far enough.
"Anyway, Dmitri, how will we know when Grady wants to go forward?"
"I will call him.
He left me a mobile phone number, which I can use at certain times of the day."
"Trustful soul?"
"For me, yes. We have been friends since the 1980s, back when he was in the Bekaa Valley. And besides, the phone is mobile, probably bought with a false credit card by someone else entirely. These things are very useful to intelligence officers. They are difficult to track, unless you have very sophisticated equipment. America has them, and so does England, but other nations, no, not very many of them.
Well, call him as soon as you think proper. We want this one to run, don't we, John?"
"Yes," Dr. Breitling said definitively. "Bill, set up the money for the transfer tomorrow. Dmitri, go ahead and set up the bank account."
"Yes, John," Popov replied, as the dessert cart approached the table.
Grady, they saw, was excited about this mission. It was approaching 2 in the Dublin morning. The photos had been developed by a friend of the movement, and 6 of them blown up. The large ones were pinned to the wall. The small ones lay in appropriate places on a map unfolded on the work table.
"They will approach from here, right up this road. Only one place for them to park their vehicles, isn't there?"
"Agreed," Rodney Sand said, checking angles.
"Okay, Roddy, then we do this." Grady outlined the plan.
"How do we communicate?"
"Cellular phones. Every group will have one, and we'll select speed dial settings so that we can trade information rapidly and efficiently."
"Weapons?" Danny McCorley asked.
"We have plenty of those, lad. They will respond with 5 men, perhaps as many as 10, but no more than that. They've never deployed more than 10 or 11 men to a mission, even in Spain. We've counted them on the TV tapes, haven't we? 15 of us, 10 of them, and surprise works for us in both phases."
The Barry twins, Peter and Sam, looked skeptical at first, but if the mission was run quickly, if it ran according to the schedule, yes, it was possible.
"What about the women?" Timothy O'Neill asked.
"What about them?" Grady asked.
"They are our primary targets."
"A pregnant woman, Sean. It will not look good politically."
"They are Americans, and their husbands are our enemies. And they are bait for getting them close. We will not kill them at once, and if circumstances permit, they might well be left alive to mourn their loss, lad," Grady added, just to assuage the conscience of the younger man. Timmy wasn't a coward, but he did have some lingering bourgeois sentimentality. O'Neill nodded submission. Grady wasn't a man to cross, and was, in any case, their leader.
"I lead the group into the hospital, then?"
Grady nodded.
"Yes, Roddy and I will remain outside with the covering group."
"Very well, Sean," Timmy agreed, committing himself to the mission now and forever.
Chapter 26 Conclusions. One problem with an investigation like this was that you risked alerting the subject, but that couldn't always be helped. Agents Sullivan and Chatham circulated around the bar until nearly midnight, finding 2 women who knew Mary Bannister and 1 who knew Anne Pretlow. In the case of the former, they got the name of a man with whom Bannister had been seen dancing. A bar regular who hadn't shown up that night, but whose address they'd get rapidly enough from his telephone number, which was known, it seemed, to quite a few of the women here. By midnight, they were ready to leave, somewhat annoyed to have spent so much time in a lively bar drinking nothing more potent than Coca-Cola, but with a few new leads to run down. It was, so far, a typical case. Special Agent Sullivan thought of it like walking through a supermarket looking for dinner, picking over the shelves randomly, selecting things to eat,
never knowing how the selections would turn out in the kitchen.
"Morning, baby," Ding said, as he rolled out of bed, as always starting his day off with a kiss.
"Hi, Ding."
Patsy tried to roll over, but it was difficult, almost as much as sleeping on her back, unable to move with her belly full of child. It couldn't come soon enough, Patricia Clark Chavez thought, despite the discomfort the delivery was sure to inflict upon her. She felt his hand slide over the stretched skin of what had once been a flat, trim abdomen.
"How's the little guy?"
"Waking up, feels like," she answered with a distant smile, wondering what he or she would look like. Ding was convinced it had to be a boy. It seemed he would accept no other possibility. Must be a Latino thing, she figured. A physician, she knew different. Whatever it was, however, it would almost certainly be healthy. The little thing inside her had been active since she'd felt the first bloop, as she called it, at 3 months.
"There he goes," she reported, when he, she, turned over inside the sea of amniotic fluid.
Domingo Chavez felt it on the palm of his hand, smiled, and leaned down to kiss his wife again before heading to the bathroom.
"Love you, Pats," he said on the way.
As usual, the world was in its proper shape. On the way to the bathroom, he sneaked a look at the nursery, with the colored critters on the wall, and the crib all ready for use. Soon, he told himself. Just about any time, the OB had said, adding that first babies were usually late, however. 15 minutes later, he was in his morning sweats and on his way out the door. Some coffee in him, but nothing else, since he didn't like to eat breakfast before exercising. His car took the short drive to the Team 2 building where everyone else was arriving.
"Hey, Eddie," Chavez said to Price in greeting.
"Good morning, Major,"
the sergeant major called in return.
5 minutes later, the team was out on the grass, all dressed in their morning workout gear. This morning, Sergeant Mike Pierce, still the team's kill leader, led the routine. The stretching and strength exercises took 15 minutes, and then came the morning run.
"Airborne Rangers jump from planes," Pierce called, and then the remainder of the team chorused, "They ain't got no goddamn brains."
The traditional chant made perfectly good sense to Chavez, who'd been through ranger school at Fort Benning, but not jump school. It made far better sense, he thought, to come to battle in a helicopter rather than as skeet for the bastards on the ground to shoot at, a perfect target, unable to shoot back. The very idea frightened him. But he was the only member of Team 2 who'd never jumped, and that made him a fucking leg, or straight-legged infantryman, not one of the anointed people with the silver ice cream cone badge. Strange that he'd never heard any of his people josh him about it, he thought, passing the first milepost on the track. Pierce was a gifted runner and was setting a fast pace, maybe trying to get somebody to fall out. But no one would do that, and everyone knew it. At home, Ding thought Patsy was getting herself ready for work in the hospital emergency room. She was leaning toward specialization in ER medicine at the moment, which meant getting a general surgery certification. Funny that she hadn't selected her area of medical specialty yet. She certainly had the brains to do nearly anything, and her smallish hands would be perfect for surgery. She often practiced dexterity by playing with a deck of cards, and over the past few months she'd become expert at dealing seconds. She'd showed him what she was doing and how, but even then, watching closely, he couldn't see her do it, which had amazed and annoyed her husband. Her motor control nerves must be incredible, Domingo thought proudly, pounding into the third mile of the run. This was when you began to feel it, because in mile 3 your legs were thinking that they'd gone pretty far already, and maybe slowing down would be nice.
At least that was true for Ding. Two members of the team ran marathons, and as far as he'd been able to tell, those two, Loisel and Weber, respectively the smallest and largest members of the team, never got tired. The German especially, graduate of the Bundeswehr Mountain Warfare School and holder of the Bürgermeister badge, was about the toughest son of a bitch he'd ever met. And Chavez thought of himself as a tough little son of a bitch. Loisel was just like a little damned rabbit, moving along with grace and invisible power. 10 more minutes, Chavez thought, his legs starting to complain to him, but not allowing any of it to show, his face set in a calm, determined mien, almost bored as his feet pounded on the cinders of the track. Team 1 was running, too, opposite them on the track, and fortunately, neither team raced the other. They did record their times for the run, but direct competition would have forced all of the Rainbow Troopers into a destructive regimen that would only produce injuries. And enough of those happened from routine training, though Team 2 was fully mission-capable at the moment, with all injuries healed.
"Detail, quick time march!" Pierce finally called,
as they completed the morning jaunt. Another 50 meters, and they halted.
"Well, people, good morning. I hope you all enjoyed waking up for another day of safeguarding the world from the bad guys," Pierce told them, sweat on his smiling face.
"Major Chavez," he said next, walking back to his usual place in the ranks.
"Okay, gentlemen, that was a good workout. Thank you, Sergeant Pierce, for leading the run this morning. Showers and breakfast, troops, fall out."
With that command, the 2 ranks of 5 each disintegrated, the men heading off to their building to shower off the sweat. A few of them worked legs or arms a little for some exercise-induced cricks. The endorphins had kicked in, the body's own reward for exertion, creating the runner's high, as some called it, which would mellow in a few minutes to the wonderful sense of well-being that they'd enjoy for the rest of the morning. Already they were chatting back and forth about various things, professional and not. An English breakfast was much the same as an American one. Bacon, eggs, toast, coffee. English breakfast tea for some. Fuel for the coming day. Some of the troopers ate light, and some ate heavy, in accordance with their personal metabolic rates. By this time, all were in their day uniforms, ready to head off to their desks. Tim Noonan would be giving a lecture today on communications security. The new radios from E-Systems hardly needed the introduction, but Noonan wanted them to know everything about them, including how the encryption systems worked. Now the team members could talk back and forth, and anyone trying to listen in would hear only the hiss of static. The same had been true before, but the new portable radios, with their headsets and reed-thin microphones that hung out in front of their faces, were a great technical improvement, Noonan had told Chavez. Then Bill Tawney would brief them on any new developments in the intelligence and investigations on their 3 field deployments. After that came the before-lunch trip to the range for marksmanship practice, but today no live-fire, live-target exercise. Instead, they'd practice long-rope deployments from Malloy's helicopter. It promised to be a full, if routine, day for Rainbow. Chavez almost added boring to the description. But he knew that John worked hard to vary the routine. And, besides, you practiced the fundamentals, because they were, well, fundamental to getting the job done. The things you held on to when the tactical situation went to shit, and you didn't have the time to think about what to do. By this time, every Team 2 member knew how every other member thought, and so, on exercises where the actual scenario was different from the tactical intelligence they'd been given going in, somehow the team members just adapted, sometimes without words, every trooper knowing what his partner and the others in the team would do, as if they'd communicated by telepathy. That was the reward for the intensive, intellectually boring training. Team 2, and Peter Covington's Team 1, had evolved into living, thinking organisms whose parts just acted properly, and seemed to do so automatically. When Chavez thought about it, he found it remarkable. But on training exercises, it seemed as natural as breathing. Like Mike Pierce leaping over the desk in World Park. That hadn't been part of the training regimen, but he'd done it, and done it perfectly. And the only thing wrong was that his first burst hadn't taken his subject in the head, but instead had stitched down his back, causing wounds that would have been rapidly fatal, then followed it with a second burst that had blown the bastard's head apart. Boom, zap, splatter. And the other team members had trusted Pierce to cover his sector, and then, after cleansing it of opposition, to assist with others. Like the fingers of his hand, Chavez thought, able to form into a deadly fist, but also able to do separate tasks, because each finger had a brain. And they were all his men. That was the best part of all. Getting the weapons was the easiest part. It struck outsiders as comical. Irishmen with guns were like squirrels with nuts, always stashing them, and sometimes forgetting where the hell they'd been stashed. For a generation, people had shipped arms to the IRA, and the IRA had cashed them, mainly buying them for the coming time when the entire Irish nation would rise up under Provo leadership and engage the English invaders, driving them forever from the sacred soil of Ireland. Or something like that, Grady thought. He'd personally buried over 3,000 weapons, most of them Russian-made AKMS assault rifles, like this stash in a farm field in County Tipperary. He'd buried this shipment 40 meters west of a large oak tree, over the hill from the farmhouse. They were 2 meters, 6 feet, down, deep enough that the farmer's tractor wouldn't hurt or accidentally unearth them, and shallow enough that getting them took only an hour's spade work. There were 100 of them delivered in 1984 by a helpful soul he'd first met in Lebanon, along with preloaded plastic magazines, 20 per rifle. It was all in a series of boxes, the weapons and the ammunition wrapped in greased paper, the way the Russians did it, to protect them against moisture. Most of the wrappings were still intact, Grady saw, as he selected carefully. He removed 20 weapons, tearing open each one's paper to check for rust or corrosion, working the bolts back and forth, and, in every case, finding that the packing grease was intact, the same as when the weapons had left the factory at Kazan. The AKMS was the updated version of the AK-47, and these were the folding stock version, which were much easier to conceal than the full-size military shoulder weapon. More to the point, this was the weapon his people had trained on in Lebanon. It was easy to use, reliable, and concealable. Those characteristics made it perfect for the purpose intended. The 15 he took, along with 330-round magazines, were loaded into the back of the truck, and then it was time to refill the hole. After 3 hours, the truck was on its way to yet another farm, this one on the seacoast of County Cork, where there lived a farmer with whom Sean Grady had an arrangement. Sullivan and Chatham were in the office before 7 in the morning, beating the traffic and finding decent parking places for once. The first order of business was to use a computerized crisscross directory to track down the names and addresses from the phone numbers. That was quick. Next up was to meet with the three men who were reported to have known Mary Bannister and Ann Pretlow and interview them. It was possible that one of them was a serial killer or kidnapper. If the first, he would probably be a very clever and circumspect criminal. A serial killer was a hunter of human beings. The smart ones acted strangely like soldiers, first scouting out their victims, discerning their habits and weaknesses, and then moving in to use them as entertaining toys until the fun faded,
and it was time to kill them. The homicide aspects of a serial killer's activities were not, strictly speaking, in the purview of the FBI. But the kidnapping was. If the killer had moved his victims across state lines, and since there was a state line only a few hundred yards from Manhattan, that was enough to allow the agents to look into it. They'd have to ask their questions carefully, and remember that a serial killer almost always had an elegant disguise, the better to win the trust of his victims. He'd be kind, maybe handsome, friendly, and totally non-threatening. Until it was too late. And at that point his victim was doomed. He was, both agents knew, the most dangerous of criminals. Subject F-4 was progressing rapidly. Neither the interferon nor the interleukin-3A had touched her Shiva strands, which were replicating with gusto, and, in her case, attacking her liver with ferocious speed. The same was true of her pancreas, which was disintegrating, causing a serious internal bleed. Strange, Dr. Kilgore thought. The Shiva had taken its time to assert itself. But then, once it had started affecting the test subject's body, it had gone to town, eating away like a glutton at a feast. Mary Bannister, he decided, had about 5 days left. M7, Chip Smitten, was little better off. His immune system was doing its best, but Shiva was just too malignant for him, working more slowly than in F4, but just as inexorably. F5, Ann Pretlow, was from the deep end of the gene pool. He'd bothered to take full medical histories of all the current crop of test subjects. Bannister had a family history of cancer. Breast cancer had claimed her mother and grandmother, and he saw that Shiva was working rapidly in her. Might there be a correlation between vulnerability to cancer and infectious disease? Could that indicate that cancer was fundamentally a disease of the immune system, as many physician scientists suspected? It was the stuff of a paper for the New England Journal of Medicine. Might get himself some additional standing in his community. But he didn't have the time. And anyway, by the time he published, there'd be few to read it. Well, it would be something to talk about in Kansas, because they'd still be practicing medicine there, and still working on the Immortality Project. Most of Horizon's best medical researchers were not really part of the project. But they couldn't kill them, could they? And so, like many others, they'd find themselves beneficiaries of the project's largesse. They would be allowing far more people than necessary to live. Oh, sure, they needed the genetic diversity, and why not pick smart people who'd eventually understand why the project had done what it had? And even if they didn't, what choice would they have but to live? All of them were earmarked for the B vaccine Steve Berg had developed along with the lethal A variant. In any case, his speculation had scientific value, even though it was singularly useless for the test subjects who now filled every available room in the treatment area. Kilgore gathered his notes and started rounds, beginning with F4, Mary Bannister. Only the heavy morphine dose made life tolerable for her. The dosage might have killed a healthy person, and would have been enough to delight the most hardened IV drug user. "How are we feeling this morning?" the doctor asked brightly. "Tired, weak, crummy," Mary Bannister replied. "How's the pain, Mary?" "It's there, but not so bad. Mainly my stomach." Her face was deathly pale from the internal bleeding, and the petechiae were sufficiently prominent on her face that she couldn't be allowed to use a mirror, lest the sight panic her. They wanted all the subjects to die comfortably. It would be far less trouble for everyone that way. A kindness not shown to other test subjects, Kilgore thought. It wasn't fair, but it was practical. The lower animals they tested
didn't have the capacity to make trouble, and there were no useful data on how to medicate them against pain. Maybe he'd develop some in Kansas. That would be a worthy use of his abilities, he thought, as he made another upward adjustment in F4's morphine drip. Just enough to, yes, make her stuporous. He could show her the mercy he would have liked to have shown rhesus monkeys. Would they do animal experimentation in Kansas? There would be practical difficulties. Getting the animals to the labs would be very difficult in the absence of international air freight service. And then there was the aesthetic issue. Many of the project members would not approve. And they had a point. But, damn it, it was hard to develop drugs and treatment modalities without some animal testing. Yes, Kilgore thought, leaving one treatment room for another, it was tough on the conscience. But scientific progress had a price, and they were saving literally millions of animals, weren't they? They'd needed thousands of animals to develop Shiva, and nobody had really objected to that. Another subject for discussion at the staff conference, he decided, entering M7's room. "How are we feeling, Chip?" he asked. They collectively thanked Providence for the lack of Garda in this part of County Cork. There was little crime after all, and therefore little reason for them. The Irish National Police were as efficient as their British colleagues, and their intelligence section unfortunately cooperated with the five people in London. But neither service had managed to find Sean Grady. At least not after he'd identified and eliminated the informers in his cell. Both of them had vanished from the face of the earth and fed the salmon, or whatever fish liked the taste of informer flesh. Grady remembered the looks on their faces as they protested their innocence right up until the moment they'd been thrown into the sea, 15 miles offshore, with iron weights on their legs. Protested their innocence? Then why had the SAS never troubled his cell again after 3 serious attempts to eliminate them all? Innocence be damned. They had half-filled a delightful provincial pub called the Foggy Dew, named after a favored rebel song, after several hours of weapons practice on the isolated coastal farm, which was too far from civilization for people to hear the distinctive chatter of automatic weapons fire. It had required a few magazines each for his men to reassert their expertise with the AKMS assault rifles. But shoulder weapons were easily mastered, and that one more easily than most. Now they talked about non-business matters, just a bunch of friends having a few pints. Most watched the football game on the wall-hung telly. Grady did the same, but with his brain in neutral, letting it slide over the next mission, examining and re-examining the scene in his mind, thinking about how quickly the British or this new rainbow group might arrive. The direction of their approach was obvious. He had that all planned for, and the more he went over his operational concept, the better he seemed to like it. He might well lose some people, but that was the cost of doing business for the revolutionary. And looking around the pub at his people, he knew that they accepted the risks just as readily as he did. He checked his watch, subtracted 5 hours, and reached into his pocket to turn on his cell phone. He did this 3 times per day, never leaving it on for more than 10 minutes at a time, as a security measure. He had to be careful. Only that knowledge, and some luck, he admitted to himself, had allowed him to carry on the war this long. 2 minutes later it rang. Grady rose from his seat and walked outside to take the call.
"Hello?"
"Sean, this is Joe."
"Hello, Joe," Grady said pleasantly. "How are things in Switzerland?"
"Actually, I'm in New York at the moment. I just wanted to tell you that the business thing we talked about, the financing, it's done," Popoff told him.
"Excellent. What of the other matter, Joe?"
"I'll be bringing that myself.
I'll be over in 2 days. I'm flying into Shannon on my business jet. I should get in about 6:30 in the morning.
I shall be there to see you, Grady promised.
Okay, my friend, I will see you then.
Goodbye, Joe.
Bye, Sean.
And the line went dead. Grady thumbed off the power and replaced the phone in his pocket. If anyone had overheard it, not likely, since he could see all the way to the horizon, and there were no parked trucks in evidence, and besides, if anyone knew where he was, they would have come after him and his men with a platoon of soldiers and or police. All they would have heard was a business chat, brief, cryptic, and to the point. He went back inside.
"Who was that, Sean?"
Roddy Sands asked.
"That was Joe," Grady replied. "He's done what we asked. So I suppose we get to move forward as well."
"Indeed."
Roddy hoisted his pint glass in salute.
The Security Service, once called MI, Military Intelligence 5, had lived for more than a generation with two high-profile missions. One was to keep track of Soviet penetration agents within the British government, a regrettably busy mission, since the KGB and its antecedents had more than once penetrated British security. At one point, they'd almost gotten their agent in place, Kim Philby, in charge of Five, thus nearly giving the Soviets control of the British counterintelligence service, a miscue that still sent a collective shiver throughout Five. The second mission was the penetration of the Irish Republican Army and other Irish terrorist groups, the better to identify their leaders and eliminate them. For this war was fought by the old rules. Sometimes police were called in to make arrests, and other times SAS commandos were deployed to handle things more directly. The differences in technique had resulted from the inability of Her Majesty's government to decide if the Irish problem was a matter of crime or national security. The result of that indecision had been the lengthening of the Troubles by at least a decade, in the view of the American FBI. But the employees of Five didn't have the ability to make policy. That was done by elected officials, who often as not failed to listen to the trained experts who'd spent their lives handling such matters. Without the ability to make or affect policy, they soldiered on, assembling and maintaining voluminous records of known and suspected IRA operatives for eventual action by other government agencies. This was done mainly by recruiting informers. Informing on one's comrades was another old Irish tradition, and one that the British had long exploited for their own ends. They speculated on its origins. Part of it, they all thought, was religion. The IRA regarded itself as the protector of Catholic Irishmen. And with that identification came a price. The rules and ethics of Catholicism often spilled over into the hearts and minds of people who killed in the name of their religious affiliation. One of the things that spilled over was guilt. On the one hand, guilt was an inevitable result of their revolutionary activity. And, on the other hand, it was the one thing they could not afford to entertain in their own consciences. Five had a thick file on Sean Grady, as they did for many others. Grady's was special, though, since they'd once had a particularly well-placed informer in his unit, who had unfortunately disappeared, doubtless murdered by him. They knew that Grady had given up kneecapping early on, and chosen murder as a more permanent way of dealing with security leaks, and one that never left bodies about for the police to find. Five had 23 informants currently working in various PIRA units. 4 were women of looser morality than was usual in Ireland. The other 19 were men who'd been recruited one way or another, though 3 of them didn't know that they were sharing secrets with British agents. The Security Service did its collective best to protect them, and more than a few had been taken to England after their usefulness had been exhausted, then flown to Canada, usually, for a new, safer life.
But in the main, Five treated them as assets to be milked for as long as possible, because the majority of them were people who'd killed or assisted others in killing. And that made them both criminals and traitors, whose consciences had been just a little too late to encourage much in the way of sympathy from the case officers who worked them. Grady, the current file said, had fallen off the face of the earth. It was possible, some supposed, that he'd been killed by a rival, but probably not, as that bit of news would have percolated through the PIRA leadership. Grady was respected even by his factional enemies in the movement as a true believer in the cause, and an effective operator who had killed more than his fair share of cops and soldiers in Londonderry. And the security service still wanted him for the three SAS troopers he'd somehow captured, tortured, and killed. Those bodies had been recovered, and the collective rage in SAS hadn't gone away. For the 22nd Special Air Service Regiment never forgave and never forgot such things. Killing, perhaps, but never torture. Cyril Holt, Deputy Director of the Security Service, was doing his quarterly review of the major case files, and stopped when he got to Grady's. He'd disappeared from the scope entirely. If he'd died, Holt would have heard about it. It was also possible that he'd given up the fight, seen that his parent organization was finally ready to negotiate some sort of peace, and decided to play along by terminating his operations. But Holt and his people didn't believe that either. The psychological profile that had been drawn up by the chief of psychiatry at Guy's Hospital in London said that he'd be one of the last to set the gun down and look for a peaceful occupation. The third possibility was that he was still lurking out there, maybe in Ulster, maybe in the Republic. More probably the latter, because Five had most of its informants in the north. Holt looked at the photos of Grady and his collection of 20 or so PIRA soldiers, for whom there were also files. None of the pictures were very good, despite the computer enhancement. He had to assume he was still active, leading his militant PIRA faction somehow, planning operations that might or might not come off, but meanwhile keeping a low profile with the cover identities he had to have generated. All he could do was keep a watch on them. Holt made a brief notation, closed the file, placed it on his outpile, and selected another. By the following day, the notations would be placed into the Five computer, which was slowly supplanting the paper files, but which Holt didn't like to use. He preferred files he could hold in his hands.
"That quickly?" Popoff asked.
"Why not?"
Breitling responded.
"As you say, sir. And the cocaine?" he added distastefully.
"The suitcase is packed. 10 pounds in medically pure compounding condition from our own stores. The bag will be on the plane."
Popoff didn't like the idea of transporting drugs at all. It wasn't a case of sudden morality, but simply concern about customs officials and luggage-sniffing dogs. Breitling saw the worry on his face and smiled.
"Relax, Dmitri. If there is any problem, you're transporting the stuff to our subsidiary in Dublin. You'll have documents to that effect. Just try to make sure you don't need to use them. It could be embarrassing."
"As you say." Popoff allowed himself to be relieved. He'd be flying a chartered Gulfstream 5 private business jet this time, because bringing the drugs through a real airport on a real international flight was just a little too dangerous. European countries tended to give casual treatment to arriving Americans, whose main objective was to spend their dollars, not cause trouble. But everyone had dogs now, because every country in the world worried about narcotics.
"Tonight?"
Breitling nodded and checked his watch.
"The plane'll be at Teterboro Airport. Be there at 6.
Popoff left and caught a cab back to his apartment. Packing wasn't difficult, but thinking was. Breitling was violating the most rudimentary security considerations here.
chartering a private business jet linked his corporation with Popoff for the first time, as did the protective documentation attached to the cocaine. There was no effort to cut Popoff loose from his employer. Perhaps that meant that Breitling didn't trust his employer's loyalty, didn't trust that, if arrested, he would keep his mouth shut. But no, Dmitri Arkadyevich thought. If he wasn't trusted, then the mission would not be undertaken. Popoff had always been the link between Breitling and the terrorists. So, the Russian thought, he does trust me. But he was also violating security. And that could only mean that in Breitling's mind security didn't matter. Why? How could it not matter? Perhaps Breitling planned to have him eliminated? That was a possibility, but he didn't think so. Breitling was ruthless, but not sufficiently clever. Rather, too clever. He would have to consider the possibility that Popoff had left a written record somewhere, that his death would trigger the unveiling of his own part in mass murder. So he could discount that, the Russian thought. Then what? The former intelligence officer looked in the mirror at a face that still didn't know what it needed to know. From the beginning, he'd been seduced by money. He'd turned into a hired agent of sorts, motivated by personal gain, the M of mice, but was working for someone for whom money had no importance. Even CIA, rich as it had always been, measured the money it gave out to its agents. The American intelligence service paid 100 times better than its Russian counterpart, but even that had to be justified, because CIA had accountants who ruled the field officers as the Tsar's courtiers and bureaucrats had once ruled over the smallest village. Popoff knew from his research that Horizon Corporation had a huge amount of money, but one did not become wealthy from profligacy. In a capitalist society, one became wealthy by cleverness, perhaps ruthlessness, but not by stupidity, and throwing money about as a government agency did was stupid. So what was it, Dmitri wondered, moving away from the mirror and packing his bag? Whatever he's planning, whatever his reason for these terrorist incidents, is close at hand. That did make a little sense. You concealed as long as you had to, but when you no longer had to, then you didn't waste the effort. It was an amateur's move, though. An amateur, even a gifted one like Breitling, didn't know, hadn't learned from bitter institutional experience, that you never broke tradecraft, even after an operation had been successfully concluded, because even then your enemy might find things out that he could use against you in your next one. Unless there is not to be a next one, Dmitri thought, as he selected his underwear. Is this the last operation to be run? No, he corrected himself, is this the last operation which I need to run? He ran through it again. The operations had grown in magnitude, until now he was transporting cocaine to make a terrorist happy, after transferring $6 million. To make the drug smuggling easier, he would have documentation to justify the drug shipment from one branch of a major corporation to another, tying himself and the drugs to Breitling's company. Perhaps his false ID would hold up if the police showed interest in him. Well, they would almost certainly hold up, unless the Garda had a direct line into MI5, which was not likely, and neither was it likely that the British Security Service had his cover name, or even a photo, good or bad. And besides, he'd changed his haircut ages ago. No, Popoff decided as he finished packing. The only thing that made sense was that this was the last operation. Breitling would be closing things down. To Popoff, that meant that this was his last chance to cash in. And so he found himself hoping that Grady and his band of murderers would come to as shabby an end as all the others in Bern and Vienna, and even Spain, though he'd had no part in that one. He had the number and control code for the new Swiss account, and in that was enough money to support him for the rest of his life. All he needed to happen was for the Rainbow Team to kill them off, and then he could disappear forever. With that hopeful thought in his mind, Popoff went outside and